I think it's important to define what it is you're trying to accomplish. And so with me, a lot of these times on these trades, what I'm trying to accomplish is kind of an incremental protection or incremental return. It's not an all or nothing part of a portfolio.
It's going to be the end of the world, Bill. See?
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Milkshakes Markets Madness. My name is John Kutzmita. This is Brent Johnson, the man behind the dollar milkshake theory. If you're unfamiliar with that, please go to our YouTube channel at Milkshakes Pod is the handle. At the top, you'll see a playlist that says start here. It'll give you all the insight and information that you need to know about the dollar milkshake theory, which in general is talking about the dollar's role in the global financial system. Brent, looks like you are not in the Puerto Rico studio today.
No, I flew to Orlando first thing this morning. I'm here for the Rebel Capitalist Live Conference. George Gammon throws it every year. I'm actually not presenting this year. I think I'm on a panel or something, but it's nice to kind of be up here and see a bunch of old friends and meet a bunch of people and, you know, just kind of hang out and talk markets.
Yeah, you are a familiar face in that crowd, so I'm sure everyone's going to be looking forward to catching up with you. Although not much has changed in your bigger picture, certainly a lot has changed in the last 12 months just in terms of market behavior. You know, you are oftentimes misunderstood. The dollar milkshake guy, they think you're, you know, in love with the dollar, and it's more this narrative or story around why hegemony takes a lot longer to be dethroned or to be passed on. And really at the core of your thesis is you are a precious metals bull. And, you know, the thing that, you know, gets people riled up is, number one, I don't think they understand that because you're labeled the dollar guy. But then you go out there and you do things like put on these defensive positions and publicize, you know, something like the silver put that you made, I think, last week. Do us a favor, explain a little bit. You know, we've talked a lot on recent episodes, your mindset about how you approach your investments and in the portfolio. I definitely want to hear how you structure the portfolio based on that mindset. But first, start us off with what you were thinking and how you structured this silver trade so that people understand it's not a one-way short position. It's more kind of, you know, playing the oscillations in the market.
Yeah, so this is a good opportunity to kind of give you just a quick little insight into kind of how I think about a portfolio and how I structure a portfolio for both a long-term thesis as well as short-term moves. And what I'm going to say here is I'm going to give you a quick little snippet, but you know, you and I have talked about this, and we're actually going to have a Milkshakes masterclass, for a better way of saying it, later this summer. And we're going to go into a deep dive on that. And so, you know, I think if that's something that you're really interested in and want to really dig deep into what the milkshake theory is, why I came up with it, how I use it, and what it means in great detail, then that'll be an opportunity to do that. But right now, basically, I kind of think about markets in a couple different ways. And I just alluded to one is the long term and two is the short term. And it's funny, George Soros kind of talked about this in one of his books. And by no means do I think I am even in the realm of George Soros, but he said something in that really resonated with me, and that he kind of has a longer term book and then he has a shorter term book. And that it solves two things. One, it keeps your long term thesis intact, but it also allows you to kind of scratch that itch of wanting to do something. So the way I've set it up is the long term part of my portfolio, the overall asset allocation, it's pretty static. It doesn't change that. We will trade around our core positions, you know, and we'll put hedges on, or maybe we'll buy some calls in order to get some leverage from time to time based on what we think is going to happen in the short term. But we try not to change our big overall asset allocation that often, especially if we have long-term themes in there. But what we will do is we'll go both long and short in the tactical part of the portfolio. And you need to understand that the tactical part of the portfolio is maybe 5 to 10% at the most of the overall portfolio, whereas the long-term strategic part of the portfolio is like 90%, maybe even 95%. And the reason that's important is because if you screw up in your short-term tactical trades, it doesn't screw up your entire portfolio. And I also think by doing some of these short-term trades, to me at least, it helps me keep in touch with what's going on in the market today. And so, because sometimes I think if you just do long term, you can kind of lose touch with what's actually going on today. And if you just do short term, then you can kind of lose touch with what's going on kind of in the bigger picture. So I like to do both. And I like to have the majority of it in the strategic long term and the smaller portion in kind of a tactical positioning. So now let's bring this to the silver position. Now, 2 weeks ago, I don't want to screw up the dates, but I put a big thing on Twitter. I'm pretty sure it was 2 weeks ago today. And if you want to go find that and read it, you can get all the details there as well. But essentially what I was saying was that even though I am a precious metals bull long-term, especially gold, I don't really have a strong opinion on silver. I think over time, silver will probably go up even more than gold in percentage terms, but it's going to be much more volatile and it's not a sure thing as gold is. So I don't own silver as a strategic position in the portfolio. Maybe at some point I will, but right now I don't. We own gold in the portfolio, and that's a long-term strategic asset that we don't sell. And we'll trade around it a little bit, but that's not something that we go in and out of on an overall basis. We have our strategic gold allocation and we keep it. But when you're going to do short-term tactical trades, there's times to do them and there's times to not do them. And if you are going to trade both directions, in other words, if you're going to trade to the upside and trade to the downside, in other words, trading the fluctuations both up and down, the time you want to trade the downside is when absolutely nobody thinks it can go down. And you want to do it when everybody is long. And so 2 weeks ago, the relative strength on silver was as high as it's been in over five years. The sentiment index was as high as it's been in over 5 years. The speculative position on the commitment of traders report was as bullish as it's been in 5 years. And the short position on the commercials, which is typically a pretty good indicator when things really start to get extended that you're going to have a pullback, it wasn't as big as it's been in 5 years, but it was pretty close. And so when I put all those things together and just people were losing their minds on Twitter about, this is it. Silver is going to $50. You missed it and all this kind of stuff. And so to me, that's if you're going to do a short-term trade, that's the time to do it. Now, the first thing I'll say is this trade is not of this. I'm not all in on this trade. This is a piece of the tactical portion of the portfolio, and the tactical portion of the portfolio is a small portion of the portfolio. So if this goes against me, it's not going to wreck me and it's not going to knock me out of the game. If it goes my way, it's going to help me incrementally, but it's not going to change my life. But those are the types of trades that I like to do every now and then. And so right when I put the trade on, silver was a little bit higher than it is now. When I put the trade on, it actually went my way right away. And then we had a big last Monday. It was the markets were closed. The futures markets were open, but the general markets were closed for Memorial Day. And gold and silver had a huge move up. And so a lot of people thought, again, Brent missed it. This got this wrong. And when I came in on Tuesday and Wednesday, we actually added to our put position because it was kind of back to where we had, initially put them on. So we added to that a little bit this week. And now today we had a big sell-off again, and now those puts are a little bit they're up from where we bought them at this point. But here's the thing: there's no guarantee that these are going to pay off, and until I either sell them or they expire, the game's not over, right? And so the way it works is there's a strike price, and if you buy puts at a certain strike, then that gives you the option to sell the position at that price during in expiration. And so if I hold these through expiration and silver is below that put price, then I will be able to sell them for a profit. I might be able to sell them before. I may decide to get out of it. But as of right now, I like that trade. I think there's probably going to be a couple weeks worth of weakness in silver. Maybe I'll make a little bit. Maybe I'll make a lot. But, that's the thinking behind it. But it's part of, again, it's not. I think too often, especially on Twitter or social media, people say I'm doing a trade, or they'll talk about trade and think they're all in on it. And or they think that somebody else's side is all in on it. For me, as a professional money manager, it's just a position. And again, in an overall portfolio, a 5% position in an overall portfolio, that's a pretty big position. I often talk to people at conferences, and they've got 25, 35, 40% of their portfolio in one thing. And listen, if that works for you, that's great, but that's not the right way to manage money. If you're managing money for other people who have a low risk tolerance, if they're in retirement, if they're not looking to double their money and they don't want to, you know, be down 40, have a 40% drawdown. So I think it's important to define what it is you're trying to accomplish. And so with me, a lot of these times on these trades, what I'm trying to accomplish is kind of an incremental protection or incremental return. It's not an all or nothing part of a portfolio.
Brent, is it too much to ask giving us a range? Like is 31 or 30 kind of the line where those puts are in profit? Is there a certain point where it gets, you know, the rally goes up and you're like, well, yeah.
I did most of them on the derivative, which is SLV. I did it on the ETF. I did do some in the futures market, but that's a much smaller position. The ones in the futures market are the strikes, I think, are 29 and 30. And in SLV, I think the strikes are from 29 until 26. There's various positions, but yeah, so that's the range. So as an example, let's just, if SLV goes to 25 in the next month, then those profits, then those puts will make a lot of money. If SLV goes to 31 and stays there for the next month, then those puts will expire worthless and the premium that I spent to buy those puts will be lost. Typically what I will do, and the reason I said I have multiple strikes is, you know, I will buy a strike, but then I'll buy the strike below it as well. And so as an example, with the 29s that we had, we sold the 29s today, but now we still got our 28s or 27s. And so as the price comes down and those puts go into profit, we'll sell them. And then we've got the other one below, and when it goes below that one, then we'll sell that one. So we will often have a staggered set of strikes rather than just one strike. But again, that's the way we did it this time. We don't always do it that way, but that's not unusual for me to have staggered strikes like that.
Well, look, the show here is Milkshakes Markets Madness. It's definitely been a bit maddening for a lot of people the last 2 years because the narratives, or at least historically, the types of things that you would expect to happen in a rate hiking cycle and you know, where liquidity is in theory being pulled back in because of quantitative tightening, a lot of these should-haves haven't happened. And we talk a lot about, you know, the word should be removed from your vocabulary, the word never should be removed from your vocabulary. So it's definitely been a bit of a maddening 24 months. And as you're mentioning here, there seems to be more and more and more, the longer this market goes, people digging into their bias and not willing to look on the other side. And it's interesting because you do have this long-term framework that you've established with the milkshake theory, but by being tactical and being active in the market, it actually helps you question your long-term narrative.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, trading both ways on the market is not for everybody. And if it's not your thing and you don't want to try to pick up some tactical trades on the way, you just want to have that's perfectly legitimate. There's a million different ways to make money. I just like to do it this way. And so again, when everything gets extreme, part of the reason I posted that on Twitter is, number one, I knew it would get a reaction, right? But I also, I thought maybe I'd get some information that I had not thought of that would help me understand why maybe I shouldn't have done that trade. Now, all the arguments that I got of why I shouldn't do the trade, I already knew all of those. The fundamental, you know, backdrop for silver is good. They're going to print a bunch of money. They have to inflate away the debt. You know, the world's in trouble. There's all these geopolitical concerns. So I get it. I totally understand the long-term thesis for owning precious metals. So part of the reason I put it on there was I thought maybe I'd get some nugget that I hadn't thought of, and I didn't really get that. But the other part of the reason I put it on there is the number one reason I put it on there is I think I'll make money doing it, right? That is, to be clear, that is the number one reason to do it. But part of the reason I decided to put it out there publicly is to show people that you can have a long-term view and do a short-term trade against it. And also to give an example that even if silver is going to $50 or $100 or whatever the number is, markets don't go in a straight line. They trend up, They pull back, they trend up, they pull back. Sometimes they stay down for a while. Sometimes they run for a while. But markets don't move in a straight line. And the Rick Rule said one time, you know, to me years ago, and it took me a long time to figure this out. He said, if you're going to be in the natural resource space, and he wasn't specifically talking about silver or gold, but often this is the case with commodities or real assets. He said, you're either going to be a contrarian or you're going to be a victim. And it took me a long time to figure out that being a contrarian meant being a contrarian within the natural resource world itself. A lot of times people that are invested in natural resources, because it's kind of a smaller market, because a lot of people don't play in it, they think just because they're in it, that they're a contrarian. And while they may be a contrarian to the larger global financial markets, they're doing the exact same thing that everybody else is doing within that industry. And so it took me a long time to figure out that when commodities have trended really hard in one direction and sentiment is off the charts and positioning is off the charts, more likely than not, you're going to get at least a pullback. And, you know, so far that's what we've gotten. Now, whether it continues, I don't know. You know, we'll have to wait and kind of see how this plays out. But that is, you know, I put it out there as a way to start a conversation. I knew some people would hate it. I knew some people would like it. But I also thought we would have the opportunity to talk about it on this show like this, and I could help explain to maybe people that are actually trying to learn and understand how markets work, that they don't just go in a straight line. Nothing just goes straight up in a line forever without pullbacks, especially in financial markets.
Excellent. I appreciate that. And as you mentioned earlier, we're going to be preparing a deep dive into this. You can get more information on that. It will be kind of a premium service, something that people will have to pay to get access to. If you are interested, it's really quick to find out more. Just send us an email at masterclass@milkshakespod.com. That's masterclass@milkshakespod.com. Just a quick email with your name. We'll keep you up to date on the details as they unfold. But Brent has been working on that in the background, so there'll be more information coming out on that soon. Get your email in now and you'll have access to discounts that we're definitely going to put out there for everybody who's involved in this early. You know, Brent, you're talking about, you know, this is slightly off script for some of the things that we saw this past week and wanted to talk about, but because you're talking about the commodity sector as a whole, we did have Chicago PMI come in at a four-year low. It's in recession territory, and this is getting people a little worked up about, you know, that this is somehow clearance for the Fed to cut rates. At the same time, oil amongst all the commodities, which is, I think, you know, the contrarian air quotes favorite thing to talk about that's going, you know, hyperbolic at some point here in the future, man, it's just struggling. So are you seeing that as a correlation between the PMIs and you know, maybe the economy is rolling over? Or is this just another one of those things where it's just people got too hyped up about something that's going to take longer to play out?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit of both. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I know exactly what's going to happen or why. But this is what I would say is, again, it kind of gets back to, I think there's this idea or thesis out there that, you know, the world is in trouble. The way that the central banks and the monetary authorities are going to deal with it is they're going to, you know, extend the game, print more money, debase the currency, however you want to define that, right? And as a result, the only thing you have to do is go out and buy real assets and just hold on, and they'll inflate it. You know, as they debase the currency, those assets will rise. And it's not that that's wrong, and it's not that I disagree with that. I think there's certainly a place for commodities in a portfolio, but I don't think it's as easy as just saying that, right? And I think we touched on this a little bit last week, but let me give you an example. Let's pretend that you're kind of new to this and, you know, or maybe you just started managing your old portfolio and you wanted to take a little bit more active role in it. And you went to a conference, you know, in April, and you heard a bunch of very smart and educated and successful people explain this to you, that currency is going to get debased. You need to own real assets, and, you know, the currency is going to lose value and these commodities are going to go through the roof. And you said, well, that sounds really smart. So then you came back and you bought oil. You bought copper, you bought silver, and you bought gold. That's a pretty good mix of commodities. Well, over the next 2 weeks, they all went down 10 or 15%. So, you know, then this gets back to my point. Like, things don't just go in a straight line. And so I don't think it's quite as easy, especially with the overall. Now, if you've got 10% of your portfolio in commodities or 15 or whatever the number is, and it pulls back 10%, that's actually no big deal. And I would encourage you to think like that. Don't worry about every little drawdown. But my point is if you heard that speech and you think it's going to be easy, and you go and you put 50% of your portfolio in hard assets, and then all of a sudden you're down 15% in 10 days, that hurts a little bit, right? And so I don't think it's quite as simple as just, unless you have a, you know, if you're 25 years old and you have a 25-year time horizon, you have plenty of income coming in from another source, you don't need to draw on your portfolio, then that makes it a little bit easier. But if you're, you know, in retirement or moving towards retirement and you need to protect against drawdowns, you know, you can get some major drawdowns in commodity prices, even in an inflationary environment.
You know, what didn't have a drawdown this week, which was kind of surprising and closing out both today and the week positive, were some of the major indexes, specifically the Dow Jones. Correct me if I'm wrong. We were talking about this before we started recording. Did it have the best day of the year today? And with that in mind, is this another sign that this is how the dollar milkshake theory is going to play out? This flight to safety, this sucking in of global capital, is it moving into blue chips because of that?
To be honest, this week was a little bit maddening for me because, again, I feel like I'm in a little bit of neutral right now, and I would like to get out of neutral. But let me tell you why I feel like I'm in neutral a little bit, because, you know, the indexes kind of hit a high back in, I guess it was it April? I guess it was April. And then they had a hard pullback at the beginning of April. I guess they kind of made the high at the beginning of April, had a hard pullback into the middle of April. And then everything kind of trended up for the next 4 to 6 weeks, kind of got back to the highs a week and a half ago. And then last week, you know, and even up until this morning, you know, the Dow had been down. The S&P was held up better than most. The Russell, you know, was down early in the week, but then recovered. And then this morning, the Dow was down initially, but then it had its best up day, I think, of the year. And whereas the NASDAQ was down 1.5% at one point today, I think it closed up 0.5% or something. We're in this place where markets have kind of hit the high. They pulled back. They're back up at those highs, but they're kind of bumping their head and falling down again. And we've got some of the markets are selling off more than the others, but yeah, and we're coming into a Fed meeting, and now every single thing that comes out, whether it's, you know, PMIs or the CPI or every little bit of data is just analyzed 10 ways to Sunday, because they're trying to figure out what is Powell going to do. So, but to answer your question, I do think this is how, in the years ahead, U.S. equity, specifically big blue chip and like the Dow type companies and even the technology companies, I think are going to go a lot higher than many people think. And I think for a lot of the reasons that they're going up now. Having said that, I don't think the Fed is going to cut. I don't think the Fed has enough ammunition to cut yet. So I don't expect them to cut, is it next 2 weeks from now? I can't rule it out. If they do, they do. But I think that's unlikely. I think what's more likely is that perhaps we get some softness into July, August, and then they cut in September right in front of the election. I know there's a lot of people who don't think that they will cut in front of the election. I don't think they care. I think they'll cut in front of the election if they want to. And with the cuts, I don't anticipate a number of cuts. I think they might cut once just so they can say they cut, because they've telegraphed it so hard. But unless we get major weakness, I think it may be a one cut and done type thing. We've had a good year so far this year. You know, there's that old adage, you know, sell in May and go away, which is kind of silly and kind of cliche. But, you know, I have to say the way I'm positioned right now is, you know, I've said this many times on here, you know, I own equities for all my clients. And I think everybody should own equities. But right now I am as hedged right now as any time I have been over the last couple of years. And part of the reason is because we're at the all-time highs. I think people are expecting more cuts than there's going to be. I think there's an opportunity for inflation to surprise to the upside. And if it doesn't surprise to the upside, then but if inflation falls, I think it could crash. I think inflation could fall really hard. And if inflation falls really hard, asset prices are probably going with it. So for all those reasons, I'm a little bit more hedged now than I typically am. The other thing I should say, I am always hedged at some point. I am never all in on everything. I always have some part of the portfolio that's either in cash or has some kind of downside protection or is some kind of a counter trade to what's going on in the bigger portfolio. Again, that's part of the tactical thing. Part of that is a function of the type of people I manage money for. A lot of the people I manage money for, you know, they're very wealthy. They've done extremely well. You know, they're either in retirement or towards retirement. Their biggest goal in the world is not beating the S&P 500. So, you know, we have to figure out the right way to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish on a risk-adjusted basis, and then we do that. Now, if you're managing money for somebody who has a different profile or has different goals, then maybe my portfolio is not totally the appropriate one for you. But I think it's always important to kind of consider what it is you're trying to accomplish when you're managing money. So as an example, some guy who gets an 8% return but has a standard deviation of 7 might be a better money manager than the guy who got a 35% return but that had a standard deviation of 24, right? And so it's on a risk-adjusted basis. I think we have it done the right way.
So you're prepared for those surprise events, which kind of makes me think about, you know, doing these interviews with you. You know, you're a tall guy, former basketball player. You've got a really large wingspan. You like to talk with your hands, and normally you can't actually see your hands because they don't fit into the camera. Every once in a while, I'll see this big mitt come across the screen. I'm almost like, I'm like dodging out of the way from it. So it's a good analogy for that. So this is a great point that you referenced, and I want you to give a little bit more clarity on it. And I also want to ask you, you know, when you talk about being in neutral, being a little frustrated, also being a little bit net short, it reminds me of some of the conversations you normally have with Todd. So I want to hear what kind of the two you've been bouncing around, but give us just a little simplicity on what that standard deviation component you just described actually means.
Well, it just basically means how much risk did you have to take in order to get the return? So let's say that if it's July and you're standing outside Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas and you're selling ice cream, you know, you took some risk to buy the ice cream. Maybe you're not going to be able to sell it, but more likely than not, you're going to be able to sell the ice cream and you're going to get a return. Meanwhile, the other guy walks into Caesar's Palace and, you know, puts $10,000 on roulette, you know. And so if you sold $10,000 of ice cream and if you made $10,000 selling ice cream and the guy that put it on roulette, you know, made $10,000 playing roulette, you guys made the same return, but who took more risk, right? The guy outside selling ice cream in 100-degree weather probably didn't take that much risk, whereas the guy who went and put it all on roulette, he took a lot of risk. And so think of that as standard deviation. That's a very simplified way of saying it, but the point is a risk-adjusted return. When I start talking about standard deviation, I'm talking about risk-adjusted returns. And I'll stay with this Las Vegas example. You know, when Evel Knievel back in the 70s, he tried to jump his motorcycle over the fountains at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. You know, and he got his motorcycle out there and he ran and he hit the ramp and he flew over and he crashed, broke every bone in his body, right? And, you know, I think he spent 9 months in the hospital. A good friend of mine, his dad actually grew up with Evel Knievel in Butte, Montana. So I've heard that story on a few different occasions. But, you know, and then I think it was 30 years later, Robbie Knievel, his son, did the same jump. And he jumped over and he landed and, you know, got all the accolades and was fine and probably went out and partied that night. The point is they both took the same amount of risk, right? One of them was successful and one of them wasn't. But just because Robbie Knievel landed the jump doesn't mean he didn't take an incredible amount of risk. He was successful. And so people don't think, when you're successful, people don't think of the risk. They only think of the risk when the crash happens. But the truth is the same amount of risk was taken on both jumps. It's just that one came out successful and the other one didn't.
Yeah. And meanwhile, everyone else who was enjoying their ice cream along the sidelines watching it had very little risk involved. What I'm going to ask is, it seems... so intense and so silly, but it seems like a necessary way to wrap up this conversation. We did have one of our followers, listeners, ask a question regarding Ray Dalio's comment talking about that the U.S. is going to head into some massive civil war. And just yesterday, Trump was convicted on these various 34 felonies related to hush money. Shortly thereafter, he ended up raising $40 million in basically a day. So it does feel like there's this intensity going on behind the scenes between the different views of the world, the different views of the country. And we've talked about this, you know, no matter where you stand or where you sit on these arguments, it's going to be a very intense time and to try to keep your head. So one, what do you think about this recent decision? Two, the comment about Ray Dalio in a civil war, do you feel like there's relevance or is that just kind of overblown hyperbole? And three, what do you think in the event where there we say we go into the election and no one accepts this election, how do you think markets react to that?
So it's all good questions. So first of all, I will say, my guess is that we have a pretty broad base of people that watch our show. I'm sure we have some urbanites, and I'm sure we have some, you know, more rural people to listen to it. I grew up in a very rural part of the United States, and most of my family still lives in kind of the Midwest and, you know, very rural, agricultural, you know, based communities. And I also spent the second half of my life in big cities. And so I have, you know, a pretty good understanding of both worlds. And all I can say is that the divisions are real. And the way of thinking, the divisions and the way of thinking are real. And so I do feel like the country is as divided now as any time in my life. And, you know, I thought Jared Dillon, the Daily Dirt Nap, I thought he put it perfectly yesterday with regard to Trump. He said, it's almost hard to believe, but the left has turned the most unsympathetic character in the world into a sympathetic character, and they just can't help themselves. And that's kind of how I feel about it. You know, I've said many times on here, I'm not a fan of Trump. You know, I wouldn't be happy if my son, you know, role modeled himself after Trump. But, you know, that doesn't change the fact that a very large part of the country likes him. And he's their guy, and he thinks that they think that he has a better understanding of their needs and wants and desires than Biden. And the other side, they think that Trump is the worst guy in the world and that Biden has the best interests of the country. And neither side is going to change. To your point, could this lead to some bigger conflict? You know, I hate to say it, but I actually think it could. Now, I don't think that's going to happen, you know, in November. It could. I won't rule it out. But, you know, the trend of the country is not great right now. This is part of my whole thesis. Like, the trend in all of these things is not good. So if my anticipation is that we will not have an accepted election this year. I've said this for a couple of years now. Whichever side wins, the other side will absolutely 100% not accept it. And I think that does not bode well for the markets in the short term. Because markets do not like uncertainty. But as we move forward in time and if the chaos gets bigger, maybe it won't, but if it does, what I think, and if we were to go into some kind of either global war or even civil war type scenario, I think that would be better for U.S. stocks than it would be for U.S. bonds. I don't know any war in history other than the initial, like maybe when the bombs start going off, bonds rally because of there's this uncertainty. But in a prolonged war that's inflationary, you probably don't want to own bonds because that's going to be a period of higher interest rates. There's going to be some questioning of whether the governments that are issuing these bonds can even pay them back, or if they do pay them back, and you know what kind of currency will it be paid back in. And so I think money will leave bonds in that scenario. And if you're in an inflationary environment, one of the best places to hedge inflation risk is in equities. Now, I know some people are out there saying, oh, you got to own gold. Yeah, of course, you should own some gold, but you shouldn't have your whole portfolio in gold. And I don't think people will put their entire portfolios in gold. And so I think they would favor U.S. equities over U.S. bonds or foreign bonds. And so I think that is partly how you get this milkshake when there's all this uncertainty and the U.S. is still even though we got problems here, it's better than elsewhere. And you know, you have people fleeing bonds and they're going into the inflation protecting asset, which is U.S. big global or big market cap U.S. equities. I think that's how you get U.S. equities going higher. And I think in that scenario, you definitely get the dollar going higher. People would say, well, why would the dollar go higher if things are so bad in the U.S. that there's a civil war? The reason is not because things are good in the U.S., but because uncertainty in the U.S. means it would be harder to keep the status quo. And the status quo currently is sending dollars to the rest of the world. The rest of the world chose the U.S. dollar as its global currency. This goes back to the 50s and the 60s when the euro dollar market first started. And then when they did the oil, the dollars for oil program, it kind of went exponential. And now the whole world uses dollars. And it's not easy for them to switch and just switch and go to something else. So if all of a sudden there's problems in the U.S., whether it's a recession, whether it's a political uncertainty, whether it's a civil war, for God's sakes, you know, then all of a sudden monetary policy becomes less certain. And, you know, the money that we would normally be sending overseas, maybe it gets redirected domestically. That means now dollars are not circulating as freely overseas. There's a supply imbalance. There's all this demand that pushes the dollar higher. So I think, and it doesn't mean, again, doesn't mean it's in a straight line. Even, you know, I talked about silver not going in a straight line, copper not going in a straight line, equities not going in a straight line. The dollar won't go in a straight line either. I should say this because I think sometimes people think I only think the dollar can go higher. Listen, it would not shock me at all if 6 months from now or 9 months from now, the dollar index was at the high 90s, mid 90s. So, you know, if they decide to, you know, start cutting rates aggressively and they want to flood the world with liquidity, yeah, the DXY can fall in the short term. But the end game, when this whole thing comes undone, that's when the dollar is going higher.
Brent, kind of a curveball here. Do you think, let's pick a timeline, I don't know, in the next 10 years, or let's say within the next four presidents, do you think any of them, along with the support and help from Congress, ends the Fed?
I think that that's possible because I think it's possible there's some kind of a merger with the Treasury and the Fed. I actually think that's something that I've thought a lot about. And I've actually wanted Daniel DiMartino Booth and I, we've discussed this a little bit, but she's somebody I would actually like to dig into this more because especially if you move towards a central bank digital currency, you start blurring the lines between what's the Fed's job and what's the Treasury's job. And, you know, this happened back in Japan, I think, in the late 70s or early 80s, where they merged the Ministry of Finance and the Bank of Japan. And as you get into, you know, Congress or the Treasury Department running more monetary policy than the Fed, and you have a central bank digital currency, which only the Treasury issues, or, you know, again, I don't think right now the Fed would issue it, but, you know, if they merged them, then the Treasury and so it wouldn't surprise me at all if, you know, 20 years from now or 16 years from now, the Fed is dramatically changed in some format.
Well, I know there was something that was passed recently that doesn't allow the Fed to create a CBDC. I'm not sure if that's been finalized or how far that's gone, but definitely something to keep an eye on because there is a lot of disdain for the Fed. And if we do get into a situation like you're talking about, you know, how does monetary policy play a role when everything is kind of being rewritten and flipped upside down? You know, one last question. Let's pretend for a second that Trump wins this election. In 2016, there was a very similar sentiment. Number one, no one thought he had any hope or chance of winning, but the sentiment was, at least for the first 30 minutes, and it might have been less than that, that if Trump won, it was going to be the end of the world. Very, very quickly, after it was clear that he had won the election, markets ramped, mainly because he is very pro-business, low interest rate, all about leverage. And that was a big kick in the teeth to the bond market. Very different environment at the time, because 2016 was right around Brexit. Bonds had kind of dipped at some point to the lowest on record or very near that. Now we're going into a situation where inflation is a big problem. It's a political problem. And if Trump is the inflationary pro-business Trump, if the narrative is the same around what he can do for the economy, what does that mean for bonds? And what does that ultimately mean for inflation if he were elected? And we're just speculating, not because we're here supporting Trump, but because we want to think about the knock-on effects.
Well, I think, and I reserve the right to change my mind tomorrow, right? As you kind of just said, but if the election were tomorrow and Trump were to get elected, I think initially markets would tend to sell off pretty hard. And the reason I say that is not because there would be uncertainty around his policies, but there would be uncertainty with how the other side would react. In 2016, nobody expected Trump to win. So there was no plan of how do we fight it if he does. I think that's dramatically different this time. I have no doubts that, you know, the other side, the Democrats or the deep state, however you want to define that, I think they have probably multiple plans in place of how they would quote unquote resist if Trump were to win again. And how that plays into markets, I don't know. But what I do know is markets don't like uncertainty, right? So I think initially there would be a lot of volatility because there would be a lot of uncertainty. Now, as Trump gets in there, as he got in there and started to kind of, you know, solidify his power a little bit more, then maybe some of that certainty leaves, and you know, we get a favorable market. But I think it's important for people to remember, when I talk about the fact that I think the U.S. dollar will go higher and U.S. equities will go higher, it's not because I think things will be good. I think it's because I think things will be bad, or that they will be challenging. In other words, the knock-on effects of things getting bad are equities going higher and bonds going lower. And I think gold would go higher with that as well. So, you know, it's kind of fun to speculate about this stuff. But, you know, my guess is there's going to be a lot of volatility leading up to the election, and probably quite a bit of volatility immediately after the election. Hopefully by the time January or February rolls around, we get a little bit more clarity on what's going to be happening.
Well, look, Brent, great conversation. I think we covered a lot about, you know, things we talk frequently about, but definitely put a different spin and light on it. A little bit of that approach with these tactical trades. If you guys want to dig deeper into that, maybe do a little bit more of a one-on-one with Brent, please send us an email at masterclass@milkshakespod.com, and we'll make sure you're on that early bird list. Brent, enjoy your conference, and we look forward to everyone joining us next weekend for another episode of Milkshakes Markets Madness. Until then, please check in with Brent on Twitter at SantiagoAUFund. You can find me there at John Katsumita, and you can find this show both on YouTube and Twitter with the handle Milkshakes Pod. That'll do it. We'll see you guys all real soon. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.